Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We're going to visit first about breaking news concerning China. The Chinese Communist Party, the evident intent to engage in military operations, at the very least against Taiwan, and perhaps against us. And the evidence that continues to accumulate that the day on which that may well get underway could be in the very near future. Our guest to discuss all of that and much more is one of our regulars here at Securing America, a man who has this beat covered handsomely. His name is Dr. Bradley Thayer. He's a colleague of mine. He's the director of our China program at the Center for Security Policy. He's a renowned academic and professor in a number of the most eminent institutions of higher learning here and abroad around the world. He has been an author of numerous books and countless essays. Among the most important of the books is his most recent, co-authored with Lian Chao Han, entitled Understanding the China Threat. Few people do better than Brad Thayer, and we're always delighted to pick his brains when he comes by. Brad, thanks for joining us. Welcome back.
Frank, it's my pleasure to join you today.
Thank you. Let me ask you first and foremost. We spoke earlier in the week with Colonel Grant Newsom about something you and your co-author at American Greatness, Jim Fennell, Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired, another of our Committee on the Present Danger China members and close colleagues here at Securing America. You've been warning for quite some time now that the Chinese are inexorably putting into place the building blocks for an attack on Taiwan and demonstrating in three different sets of exercises those capabilities, presumably to persuade Xi Jinping that they're good to go. We've talked about the first two of those exercises. The most recent, the third, has happened since we last spoke with you, I think, Brad. Tell us about it, what we know, what you think the Chinese are taking away from it.
Certainly, Frank, it's a very worrisome picture. So the Chinese are moving the big pieces into place for conducting an amphibious invasion of the island of Taiwan. In October of last year, of 22, they conducted a series of missile exercises when Nancy Pelosi, then Speaker of the House of U.S. House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, was visiting Taipei. In April, when current speaker Kevin McCarthy visited, they conducted a series of aerial exercises to ensure dominance and air superiority in the region. And now they have Lai, essentially the current vice president of Taiwan, is transiting through the United States. They have conducted an amphibious invasion. So there are three big pieces. Missiles show that you can cut off and isolate Taiwan. Aerial superiority is necessary before the amphibious assault occurs. And now they've demonstrated a multi-divisional and combined arms. So bringing, of course, what you need to do, a land power, air power, sea power have to combine to successfully conduct that amphibious assault. Earlier, about 6 weeks ago, they conducted a brigade size exercise, and now they're doing a much larger one. So James Fennell and I see the big pieces in place for the Chinese military to say to Xi Jinping that they have the capabilities in place for an invasion against Taiwan. So that's very worrisome because the capabilities are, the intent is a constant. The intent to conquer Taiwan has been there since 1949. It hasn't changed, and it only has redoubled under Xi Jinping. Now with the capabilities, the military is able to exercise that option.
Brad, just one clarification. You mentioned that the speaker incumbent speaker visited. He visited with the president of Taiwan, but in the United States, Chinese nonetheless used that as a pretext for holding one of these exercises. And with respect to this most recent exercise right there, is it your understanding of what took place that in addition to amphibious vehicles moving forces across the beach, that the Chinese also demonstrated some of the other logistical support, sea lift capabilities, roll-on, roll-off ships and the like to support such an invasion?
Indeed, they have. They did this with the brigade exercise, and they have only redoubled their efforts now with the current exercise. So it's, again, simply alarming. They're working out the logistical problems that they're going to have. They're working out essentially the formidable challenges, of course, of conducting an amphibious assault.
Across 100 miles of open water, basically, in the Taiwan Strait.
Indeed, and that certainly is going to require coordination with the Fifth Column present in Taiwan, which is certainly there, airborne assets, and then, of course, air, missile, and naval components as well. So it's a mighty problem. But again, what we're witnessing in real time, Frank, is that they're demonstrating their capabilities to do this, while the response from the Biden administration has been woefully inadequate.
And this is the point to which we keep returning with you and our other experts, Brad, is if there were any lesson to be learned from this debacle in Ukraine, it is that you want to deter acts of aggression before they happen rather than try to contend with them after they do. And that will be true in spades, especially if, Brad, as I believe is the case, the Chinese have in mind ensuring that we do not interfere with that invasion. And whether that means very direct and devastating attacks against our forces in the theater, or perhaps here at home, we've been talking with you and others about thousands, maybe 10,000 or more individuals who seem to be part of People's Liberation Army elements being insinuated across our border. We've talked recently with Sam Faddis about some coming ashore in Florida from the Bahamas. The idea that these numbers could be both insinuated into this country, then helpfully disseminated around it at American taxpayer expense, a service we provide to all illegal immigrants these days, it just suggests that we're looking at a real problem on the home front, does it not?
A major vulnerability, of course, is, as you've identified, Frank, and the, clearly the fifth column, which is present in Taiwan, but also which is being introduced into the United States, is a cause of enormous concern. As now many individuals have documented, you've had essentially units move from clearly military age men, very likely PLA units move into the United States, will be able to, of course, attack our infrastructure, attack other civilian and military targets as well. Which is a cause of great concern, and that's already present in Taiwan. So any assault would certainly be conducted with against Taiwan, would have that those fifth column elements in the U.S. and Taiwan.
Inside our wires, as they say.
Yes, indeed.
Brad Thayer, hold the thought. We'll be right back with more right after this. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Kevin Freeman is America's foremost expert on economic warfare. He's warned for years about the many ways in which the Chinese Communist Party has waged it against our country. Of particular concern is the progress the CCP and friends have made in taking down the dollar as the world's reserve currency, abetted by its relentless devaluation by our own government. The Chinese communists have made significant strides in recent months with their commodity purchases in China's currency. And this week, the so-called BRICS nations and others are expected to launch a new multilateral dollar replacement tied somehow to gold. Kevin Freeman's superb new book, Pirate Money, shows how U.S. states can constitutionally issue their own gold and silver-backed digital currencies as American alternatives to the BRICS scheme and the Federal Reserve's ominous central bank digital currency. Read Pirate Money, and then let's get some. This is Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and we're visiting with Dr. Bradley Thayer, the author of Understanding the China Threat, which he does, and he helps us do week upon week. We're so appreciative of it. Brad Thayer, in addition to the problems we've been discussing, I wanted to talk with you about allies of the United States that are experiencing their own challenges from the Chinese Communist Party and its friends in the region. Let's start with the Philippines. You have been warning now for some time that push was coming to shove with respect to something called the Second Thomas Shoal. Remind us what that is and why things are hotting up there.
Certainly, Frank. The PRC is aggressing presently, that is today, against the Philippines, a major U.S. ally, at Second Thomas Shoal, where the Philippines beached an LST, a landing ship tank, in 1999 to essentially establish, if you will, facts of the ground that Second Thomas Shoal is Filipino territory, as indeed it is, as recognized by international law. The Philippines is being tested, though, because the PRC is using their Coast Guard, in essence, to coerce resupply vessels from visiting the LST, called the Sierra Madre. And in this effort, the PRC is doing everything it can do to seize that territory, as they seized Scarborough Shoal in 2012, when the Obama administration essentially did not support our Filipino ally, and the CCP, the PRC, successfully aggressed against the Philippines.
There, and with other atolls throughout the South China Sea, which they built into fortified bastions now, notwithstanding the assignment that Joe Biden as vice president was given to precluding all of that, as I recall. I've wondered whether among the things he's been so handsomely remunerated for by the Chinese Communist Party was his taking a dive on the South China Sea islands. But that's for another day. Let's talk a little bit about, you've got an important piece with Jim Fennell about the necessity of our coming to the assistance of our Filipino allies. What are you proposing in that regard?
What we're proposing is that the United States Navy take direct action here, and that is to provide resupply, the escorting of Filipino vessels on resupply missions, but also to conduct vertical replenishment, which the United States Navy and Marine Corps, of course, are expert at conducting, to ensure that the Filipino forces on Second Thomas Shoal are resupplied, and the Philippines are thus supported. The Philippines are absolutely essential. As China is going to aggress against Taiwan, the United States must stand with the Filipinos, and it must stand in not only to help the Philippines, but also to safeguard the southern flank of Taiwan. It's absolutely essential, Frank.
Yeah. And were we to fail to help them in this moment of truth, we might well lose access once again to bases in the Philippines that are especially going to be needed in the event there is a conflict with Taiwan. Is that not correct?
Indeed, Frank. And the Biden administration has negotiated four new bases in the Philippines, which will be absolutely essential for deterrence of aggression. They're not where they should be at the present time, but we hope that there is some considerable expansion. But the Philippines safeguards Taiwan's southern flank. It's absolutely essential, as Japan does its northern flank.
Speaking of Japan, I did want to ask you, Brad, about the summit meeting that's been taking place in recent days at Camp David between the Prime Minister of Japan, President of South Korea, and Joe Biden. Give us your sense of what is coming out of those conversations. I think the fact that they're happening, given the fractured relationship that we've seen in recent years, when the left was running South Korea in particular, it's important that they're, you know, getting together at all. But what do you think is likely to be the upshot?
I think the upshot will be to strengthen cooperation, security cooperation between Seoul, Tokyo, and Washington. And I think that will include several different avenues, one of which, of course, is to have, if you will, a hotline linking all three. But more significantly, it helps to secure Taiwan's northern flank. And it helps to secure the U.S. extended deterrent to South Korea and to Japan. Very usefully, Japan has conveyed that it would intervene if the United States did to assist Taiwan, were Taiwan attacked. And we hope that the South Koreans will do so as well. So the meeting is a very positive one that is taking place, and it's one of the few positive steps, really, that the Biden administration has taken in this regard. But fundamentally, Frank, it's not addressing the key issue, which is you need to have a conventional deterrent on Taiwan. I would hope to see, as a result of this meeting, that South Korean forces, Japanese forces, Australian forces, Filipino forces, perhaps Indian forces, as well as U.S. forces, are sent to Taiwan to provide a tripwire force, a multinational tripwire force, which would be a powerful signal, one that we did many times, of course, Frank, as you well know from your years in the Pentagon, at the Reagan administration, provides a very powerful deterrent. If you have U.S. boots on the ground and U.S. and its allies' boots on the ground in Taiwan is one thing that can certainly safeguard Taiwan.
Yeah. And I think surpassing importance is that tie-in to Taiwan. And Dr. Stephen Bryan, one of our colleagues at the Center for Security Policy, observed that it would have been nice to have had the Taiwanese at this summit. Alas, that was not in the cards. I hope that an enhancement of our deterrent to prevent this prospective attack against Taiwan, as you've been arguing for so long, Brad, is going to be one of the upshots of this event. God bless you, my friend. Thank you for the work you do with us. Keep up the good work there and elsewhere, and come back to us next week. I hope the rest of you will do the same right after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we're joined by Dr. Stephen Bryan, a man I have had the privilege of knowing and working with for decades in a variety of capacities as a senior member of the congressional staff, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, as a deputy undersecretary of defense for policy, as a man who served in senior positions in the defense industrial base, notably with Finmeccanica, these days as a senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy, which I'm very proud. Steve Bryan, it's good to have you with us, sir. Welcome back.
Frank, it's lovely to be with you.
Thank you. Let me start by asking you about a really important piece that you had in Asia Times recently, in which you talked about what you called an industrial tripwire approach. Right. To Taiwan. Right. You've helped put together a book about trying to deter China from attacking Taiwan. Talk about how this fits into your larger strategy.
Yeah, thanks, Frank. Yeah, well, you know, the book basically goes through the military steps that we should be taking to help support and defend Taiwan. But it doesn't deal with economic issues. By the same token, you know, the U.S. presence in Taiwan is very minimal. We don't have a lot of exposure. We have a pseudo embassy there. Some U.S. companies work there, some important ones, but they work there as subcontractors, so to speak. And what I'm suggesting is, you know, what would deter China from attacking would be if U.S. industry was really present in Taiwan, because then they'd have to consider the risk of engaging the United States. The real game here is that the Chinese and the U.S. have a kind of kabuki about whether or not the United States is going to defend Taiwan. Chinese think they can discourage us. And they're doing a good job of it from time to time. But it seems to me if we have assets there, real hard assets of significance, economic importance, then it becomes much more difficult for China to just cavalierly attack this small island, which nobody wants or wants to deal with, because all of a sudden, it's an outpost of America. And so I think that's my argument in a nutshell.
And you are a man who has spent time in the defense industry, so you have some particular appreciation of lead times involved in getting corporations to do much of anything. How realistic is this if what we are confronting is a potentially very near-term threat from China to, well, I would argue Taiwan, but also to us?
Well, that's a good point, Frank. It takes time. There's no doubt about that. But once the policy is established clearly that the U.S. would support, openly support U.S. investment in Taiwan, I think a lot of American companies will start to find their way there very quickly. Taiwan's a very vigorous economic and intellectual center, amazingly so. Look at Taiwan Semi, which is really the crown jewel of Taiwan. It's the most advanced semiconductor company in the world. And we depend on it for our defense and for our economics as well. So I think it's an attractive place for American industry to go. Actually, in my opinion, more attractive than China ever was, because you get something back for your trouble.
Yeah. Well, this raises a really important point. Of course, there's a lot of disengaging taking place from China, we're told by American companies and others. I don't think I've heard any of them are talking about moving to Taiwan.
No, they're talking about India. They're talking about Vietnam. Of course, they're looking
here, of course. But Steve, I guess the reason that Taiwan is not mentioned is they would still like to be able to do business with China. And obviously, any company that would be, you know, playing this kind of role that you're talking about, an industrial tripwire, would be essentially foreclosing that for sure.
Not necessarily. I mean, the Chinese have never complained about American companies in Taiwan unless they're in defense. If they're openly in defense, you know, providing armaments, then the Chinese object, although only partly because they're depending on Lockheed and Boeing and others as well. So they have to kind of mix their metaphors, so to speak. But when it comes to pure, you know, economic advancement and development, the Chinese don't have anything to say about it. Of course, they're doing the same thing elsewhere.
Yeah. Well, including with the Taiwanese companies. Last time I checked, they're still doing business with some of them. Steve, this is really interesting. And, you know, I think the companion to it, which you've argued in the book, in which you were taking stock with some very senior American retired generals and admirals. Yeah, really formidable. But you were talking about a military tripwire there as well, were you not?
Yes, indeed. We were talking about trying to prevent war by organizing properly between the U.S. and Taiwan and Japan and Korea and others, trying to get organized in that way. And what I've called for in the book, and which I think is a sound approach, is a common command system, which we don't have now. So if we're called to help Taiwan militarily, the problem that we face is how do we coordinate it? And we don't have a means to do that. We don't have the communications. We don't have the command and control. But we don't have the organization. So these are things we should be fixing and urgently.
As it happens, we're going to talk more about this in a moment with Colonel Grant Newsom, but I'd be interested in whether this ought to be, well, if not the top agenda item, certainly one of the prominent ones in this three-way conversation President Biden is hosting
at Camp David
with the Japanese and South Korean.
It's too bad that we didn't invite Taiwan.
It is too bad. It occurred to me that that would be a nice touch. At the very least, they ought to be part of what comes out of all of this. Do you think that's in prospect, Steve? I mean, again, your point, which is so vital, is if we've learned anything from this miserable experience with Ukraine, it ought to be you don't want to deal with a crisis or conflict specifically after it is broken loose. You want to prevent it if you can. And you've come through with a whole bunch of good ideas as to what could be done in that regard.
We really need to put our foot to the pedal and press on the gas and let's get going, because the more time we waste and the more we kick the can down the road, the more dangerous it gets.
Yeah. Well, and in point of fact, I think it's fair to say that the more emboldening it is of the Chinese to think that they can get away with what they wish to do.
Well, yeah, they just conducted a huge invasion exercise this past week. So, you know, they're getting ready. And now, whether they decide to do it, who knows? But I'd hate to have to wait and see that happen.
Yeah, but having put everything seemingly into place, it would be the height of folly to be assuming that they're not deadly serious about pressing forward with it. Steve, let me just turn quickly to another topic, not unrelated, with respect to China. In a webinar that we did earlier this week with our Committee on the Present Danger, China, we talked about this executive order that President Biden signed recently that purportedly is going to restrict U.S. investment in three key technology sectors of particular relevance to the military, artificial intelligence, semiconductors, and quantum computing. We found that the expert team that we put together that there was probably much less to this than meets the eye. And yet one of the things that was urgently recommended was if you're serious about not having our technology or our investments in technology going into communist China, one of the things that you could usefully do is take a page out of your old playbook with something called the Coordinating Committee on Multilateral Technology Controls, as I recall, COCOM, export controls, right? Just quickly remind us of what COCOM was, and would such a thing be very valuable to have today, do you think?
Oh, I think it would be very valuable. It was terminated in 1996 when the Clinton administration wanted to open up big time trade with China. So they got rid of it.
I had actually thought it was Brent Scowcroft and the George H.W. Bush administration.
It was Clinton.
It was?
Yeah, it was finally. I mean, they were working on killing it before that, but it was finally killed by Clinton. In any case, it doesn't matter who killed it. The fact is it's not there anymore.
And what was it exactly, and how did it work?
It was an export control regime that was agreed to by all the NATO countries, plus some others, including Japan. And it was initially it was a Cold War instrument used against Russia or Soviet Union. That was the main target because that was the main strategic threat. But China was included. The difficulty is everybody wanted to keep changing the game for China and weakening the controls. In any case, something like that, especially in Asia today, could be very helpful. The way to coordinate, because look, I think when the president says, I don't want U.S. companies investing in AI or in other technologies that are of concern, most American companies are going to pay attention to that. It's not that that they're restricted really, but they understand the United States doesn't want them there, which also means the United States won't protect them there. And that's a big deal.
So if we communicate that, in a convincing way, I think
the president signed an executive order, I think is some help. He also asked my old agency, the Defense Technology Security Administration, DITSA, to enforce it. And I think that's a great step. I founded that back in 85, so it's been a long time. But they could do it. I mean, but the main thing is to go around and visit with all the American companies that are involved in this and tell them we don't want you investing.
Great idea. Steve Brine, we'll come back to you for follow-up on all of that. God bless you, my friend. We'll be right back with more. Stay tuned. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Kevin Freeman is America's foremost expert on economic warfare. He's warned for years about the many ways in which the Chinese Communist Party has waged it against our country. Of particular concern is the progress the CCP and friends have made in taking down the dollar as the world's reserve currency, abetted by its relentless devaluation by our own government. The Chinese Communists have made significant strides in recent months with their commodity purchases in China's currency. And this week, the so-called BRICS nations and others are expected to launch a new multilateral dollar replacement tied somehow to gold. Kevin Freeman's superb new book, Pirate Money, shows how U.S. states can constitutionally issue their own gold and silver-backed digital currencies as American alternatives to the BRICS scheme and the Federal Reserve's ominous central bank digital currency. Read Pirate Money, and then let's get some. This is Frank Gaffney. We're back, and what a pleasure to say we are joined by Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marine Corps retired, a man of many parts, a lawyer by training, a foreign service officer in part of his distinguished public career, a successful executive in East Asia for many years since leaving government service. He has been, among other things, for some time now, a senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy, of which I am, as always, very proud. He is also a member of the Committee on the Present Danger China and a tremendous resource for this program and the committee and so much more. We're delighted to have him with us, as always. Colonel, we catch up with you down under, as I understand it. I'm glad you're there, and I'm happy to catch you anywhere, as a matter of fact.
Sure, glad to be here. Thank you.
I've got a couple of things I want to visit with you in the course of a short block or two. One is you, Captain Fennell, Bradley Thayer, and others in our team have been for some time warning that the Chinese Communist Party has been inexorably moving forward, putting into place and demonstrating the capability to conduct attacks on Taiwan from the air, in the seas around Taiwan, the missile threat, and most recently they have undertaken, as they had been expected to do, a major amphibious exercise, something an old U.S. Marine like yourself would doubtless have taken note of. Tell us how it looked to you in terms of the size, the scale, the demonstrated capabilities, to the extent you can share insights into those.
Yeah, well, the Chinese military has been working on amphibious capabilities for a long time. And there was always a sense on the American side, well, the Chinese will never be as good as us because we're the Marines, we've been doing them forever. It'll take them decades to catch up. Well, not quite. They are fast learners. They looked at how the Marines operate and see what the component parts are. And they put together a military which can conduct amphibious operations. And keep in mind that you only have to do a certain kind of amphibious operation to go after Taiwan. You don't need to have the full range of capabilities, but they have the hardware, the know-how. They know their shortcomings, and they have practiced amphibious ops for a long time. So they are just getting better and better and better. They have the ability, as it is now, to put together the equivalent of the U.S. Marine Corps Navy MUARG, the Marine Amphibious Unit, Amphibious Ready Group, this amphibious task force that sails around the world and does things, shows the flag. The Chinese could put together at least two of those if they wanted. Of course, perfecting it takes time, but this we are now seeing the comeuppance of having condescendingly assumed that the Chinese could never be our equals when it comes to combined operations, joint operations, and even amphibious warfare. You never quite know how an actual fight is going to go. Keep that in mind. But in terms of understanding what they needed to do and setting about to do it, the Chinese have done a pretty good job of it.
Yeah. You know, as you're speaking, I'm thinking they not only went to school on how the U.S. Marines did amphibious warfare, they emulated, it seems, an awful lot of the kit, including, you know, air cushion vehicles and over the beach assets of various kinds. And Colonel, do you have an assessment of how the exercise actually went? As best one can determine it from the Chinese perspective, do you think that they now believe that they have checked the box and demonstrated to the satisfaction of, say, Xi Jinping, that they can, in fact, do the part of the job? You're absolutely right. It's not the whole of what they would do to take Taiwan, but the part of the job that would be uniquely, as they say, over the beach.
I think they can do it. And one can debate that. But this is just one piece of the puzzle, and they've put together a number of the pieces, if not all of them, that you need to at least think you have the ability to surround, isolate, strangle. and flatten Taiwan, destroy its defenses, and then go in and take the place. I think this is the really the last piece of the puzzle. And I think the Chinese think that they're good enough now for this particular fight.
And what does that then suggest might be the timing? You've written, of course, a very important book on the subject, When China Attacks. Does this, to your way of thinking now, make that an imminent threat to Taiwan, one that would await perhaps the outcome of the presidential election in Taiwan, or, you know, perhaps be postponed even further?
I think it is imminent, and I think that's a fair statement. Whether or not it's imminent means tomorrow or next month is debatable, but certainly within the next year, I think that the Chinese might have a go at it. You mentioned the upcoming Chinese Taiwanese presidential election in January 2024. Well, that's going to shape Chinese thinking if they're not happy with the outcome of it. So their guy doesn't win. That they're
and their guy would be this Kuomintang candidate who has been seen to be rather amenable to China, at least certainly relative to the Democratic, is it Progress Party in Taiwan?
Mm-hmm. That's right. And so I think that's sort of a decision point for the Chinese. But also they will be looking at the state of the United States making their decision. And the more chaotic we are, the more of a banana republic we appear to be, the more likely they're going to think, well, if we go after Taiwan, these people just aren't going to be able to do much about it. Either they won't do it, they won't want to, or even if they try, it won't be enough. So they're looking at a couple things, but I think that they have now got the so-called kinetic option mostly in place if they need to use it.
Colonel Newsom, I want to just ask you in the next block very briefly about one other consideration. And you mentioned Banana Republic, whether the Chinese are looking on the, well, cultural Marxist transformation of the United States military as another incentive to act. We'll talk about that and the South Korea, Japan, U.S. summit taking place in Camp David this weekend, right after this. We're back, and we're visiting with one of our favorite guests, certainly one of our duty experts on communist China and the threat that it poses to us, and we value his participation in this program tremendously. His name is Colonel Grant Newsom. He's a retired United States Marine. He is also a man who has served his country with distinction in its foreign service and also as a business leader in Japan. Colonel, I wanted to ask you a question. We touched on the problems that the Chinese are clearly perceiving in our country. They've got a few of their own, too, but that's a topic for another day. But they're perceiving ours, and I just wanted to draw you out on the prospect that they must be taking some considerable comfort when they look at the possibility of having to deal with the United States military. Either as a result of attacking Taiwan or as a result of attacking us, for that matter. By the well, fundamental transformation, I think Barack Obama would call it, that the United States military is undergoing at the moment, and that is in prospect if the Senate of the United States actually does confirm General C.Q. Brown to be the next chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, a man who is currently the chief of staff of the Air Force, as you know, and who has been very, well, I think clear and assiduous even about his enthusiasm for things like diversity, inclusion, and equity, the whole CRT, critical race theory agenda, transgender accommodations, climate change focus, etc. Do you think that might embolden the Chinese in their calculations as to whether this can be done, whether it's, again, Taiwan alone or Taiwan with us?
Well, I think to some extent it does. It takes a while to. There's a lot of ruination in a military like the U.S. military, and we're still pretty good. But if you keep this up, we're not going to have a military that's very good. And there need to be some really good explanations for the statements that this officer has been quoted as saying. Just think about it from a reverse perspective. What if the Chinese made promotions in their military based on how good somebody was at an exam at Xi Jinping thought, rather than their actual ability to, say, fly an airplane or shoot or just do military operations, but rather there's a political act. Bona fides are what you do to need to get promoted. And that's the effect of what we're doing. Anytime anybody talks about diversity and quotas, this sort of thing, that's no different than the Chinese saying, you know, better to be read than expert. And that'll destroy a military, sure thing, just assures
them. And again, I'm as concerned about the prospect that it will actually invite aggression as anything. I mean, deterrence is what we ought to be about, as we talked about with Steve Bryan a moment ago. And I fear all of what's happening here is not having that effect. And by the way, it's evident in the performance of the Air Force at the moment, which has been transitioning from rated as marginal to weak to now very weak by the Heritage Foundation in the space of General Brown's tenure at the Air Force Chief of Staff role. This is not good for deterrence, I'm afraid. And it's not just, again, his statements. It's the policies that he's actually been pursuing and promulgating. Colonel, let me turn to one last topic quickly with you. As we speak, two of the nations that you follow very closely, one you live in, Japan and South Korea, are meeting at their leadership levels with President Biden this weekend on the issue, really, that we've been discussing, I think, primarily China, Taiwan, assuredly, and other considerations, especially what seems to be a considerably improved relationship between South Korea and Japan. Give us just a quick reading on what is going on there. And do you agree with Steve Bryan that it would be good to have had the leadership of Taiwan represented there as well?
Well, I'll start with the first one. Of course, it would be good to have Taiwan there. It'd be good to have Taiwan at anything. But you'll notice how we never invite them. And that tells you plenty. The Taiwanese get the message that for all our protestations, we don't really care all that much about them if we won't be seen in public with them. The Chinese see the same thing. So yes, it would be good if Taiwan was there. When it comes to Japan and Korea getting along better, this is good news. And credit where it's due. The U.S. military has been trying for a long time to bring the two countries together and get some sort of basic cooperation from a military perspective. And the administration has, I think, rightly brought them to Camp David and see how far this will go. A lot does depend on the people, the person running South Korea, and that's President Yoon. He's a sensible leader. He's a conservative. But he also knows that South Korea's security is utterly dependent on the United States, and he's willing to, if not let bygones be bygones, at least act like an adult and stop trying to be like making the South Koreans the Asian of the Irish of Asia. The Japanese have got a good leader with Kishida, and he too is willing to sort of bite his tongue. And the administration is doing something good. Let's see what they produce with it. But it's, as I said, this is a good development.
Well, it is a positive development, and I know it's one you've been calling for some time, and in, you know, using your considerable influence in Japanese circles and I think national security circles more generally to advance. So kudos to you, sir, as well as the Biden team, and most especially, I think, let's face it, the leadership of South Korea, which has turned this thing around from the predecessor regime, which was behaving, well, to put your, you know, characterization of it in a rather infantile fashion. Last and very quickly, sir, there is further talk again out of Brad Sherman's office, Congressman Sherman of California, about the need for an end of war agreement. Is your position that that is still ill-advised, even under these circumstances?
No, it's completely ill-advised. Brad Sherman ought to know better. It's Congressman Sherman. He is doing the North Korean leader's bidding. That's how bad this is. And this is like a zombie that won't go away. This bill keeps coming back. And I'm surprised that North Korea doesn't send Sherman's office a gift basket from Hickory Farms.
They may well do. We have to leave it at that. Colonel, thank you for your time. As always, my friend, come back to us again soon if you would. I hope the rest of you will do the same next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.